If when you think about folklore, you conjure up leprechauns or tales spun by poor white folk in Appalachia, you may be misreading reality. And you may be missing out on an entertaining and an interesting aspect of all cultures, including the culture of mainstream America. I'm Susan McInnes with Conversations. We'll talk today with folklorist Barry Tolkien. If you're a regular listener to Conversations, you'll recognize Barry's name. Dr. Tolkien has been with us twice before to take a look at the place of folklore in cultures worldwide. Today, we'll do it again. Barry, let's start with the basics. Who's the folk, and what's folklore?
That's basic and a long subject.
We have an hour.
Basically, the folk are ourselves, but that doesn't leave us much of an answer, actually. The folk could be anybody. It used to be thought that there was a difference between the folk, who were thought to be rural and therefore subject to another kind of social organization, and the rest of the people who were urban and therefore independent and not living in any particular gathering like dairymen or fishermen or something like that. They were living on their own. We could live wherever we want if we moved to the city. So it used to be thought that the folk were rural folks or backward folks or tribal folks who simply had a different structure in culture than we. And, of course, we were the ones defining what folk was. As, you know, it's the us and them.
For the other guy. Find.
The other guy was folk and we were okay. And for a lot of people, the folk were illiterate while we're literate, or they're uneducated and we're educated. The folk were rural and we're urban. And so they developed the notion, it was a pretty old notion, I think, in early studies, that that rural people are generally behind and that folklore therefore represents the culture of a bygone era, which the rest of us have gotten away from. And now what we realize, and there are a number of reasons why we're forced to realize this, we now realize that folklore is the product of any ongoing group of people. And that includes city people, which can include occupations like doctors and lawyers and firefighters in the city, or can also include Ozarkers, and it can include Tlingit Indians or whatever, any kind of group you happen to belong to on the basis of which you continue to share customs and food lore and attitudes and worldview and jokes and songs and when you open your Christmas presents and that sort of thing. Those ongoing customs that are maintained simply by the group doing it rather than by formal authority, then you're in a folk group. So a lot of people have just abandoned the term folk group altogether and have just talked about various kinds of groups that are ongoing. That is, not the kind of group in a bus going down the street, which doesn't last very long, but a group like your family or the religion you belong to or the region you live in or the occupation you're in. And what kind of language and customs and so on have developed and have been passed on in those groups. By looking at it that way, what we now realize is that there's probably more folklore than ever before. You can at least collect more of it in the city than you can in the country. Adults have folklore, children have folklore, old folks have folklore, doctors tell jokes about leaving tools inside of people, firefighters tell anecdotes and legends about tough fires they've had, which get passed on. In Cordova last week, I was talking to the most modern of fishermen who still throw a handful of change overboard when they leave port and don't leave on Friday and pass on beliefs that are several thousand years old. The fisherman doesn't need to know that, but he's a member of a group in which doing those things and saying those things and performing those things are signs that he's a functioning member of the group. So we now recognize it in that sense, that it involves all of us. We have yet to find somebody without folklore anyway.
Do fishermen do that the world over in one way or the other? That is to say, is the folklore of fishing or doctoring or firing, whatever, is that consistent around the world?
A lot of it is. I mean, I think what you find is that with any hazardous occupation, there are a tremendous range of beliefs and customs that help to lower anxiety on the job, demonstrate proficiency, test the difference between newcomer and old-timer and so on. And sometimes they're the same the world over. Some fishing folklore is the same the world over. For example, since it's hazardous and you're always at the mercy of the sea, there's a pretty worldwide notion that the sea has to get an occasional offering, a handful of change or an occasional fish or something from the people who use it. Sort of like a good luck, like not forgetting that there's an unpredictable element in your work. But there are some specific ones. For example, not leaving port on Friday is essentially a Northern European belief, and it's spread to America. You find it all the way up the West Coast and all across Alaska. Not 100%. Some people won't follow that. But if you leave port on Friday, all your other fishermen colleagues look at you as if you're nuts. And so even if a person doesn't believe in the custom, a person would be inclined to follow it just so he won't look like a loony among his friends. And I ran into a couple of fishermen in Cordova who told me that if they have to leave, if they really want to do something on Friday, what they'll do is leave Thursday and then come back through port on Friday as if they've forgotten something, so that they will have already left on a non-Friday. It goes back to pre-Christian times. It's Friday is the sacred day for the fertility goddess in Northern Europe, whose name is Freya, Frigia. She's the one we get Friday from, Freya's Day. She's a female goddess in pre-Christian times, and she's associated with the sea and with large bodies of water. And her sacred animal is the fish. And so it was customary in Northern Europe to eat fish on Friday, but not to go out and catch fish on Friday. It was almost like fish had become a sacrament on that relatively sacred day. And that's why most of Europe eats fish. That's why we still have a custom of fish on Friday. It precedes Christianity. The Catholic Church came along and had the custom of abstaining from meat on Friday, but never said you had to eat fish. You were just supposed to not eat meat, but most of Europe was eating fish anyway. Mm. It led to some really interesting things for people in Alaska who were interested in game, for example. You know, beavers used to grow all over Europe. And as the towns and cities began to grow, beaver became a delicacy. And it was a delicacy in the monasteries and nunneries and so on as well. And so there arose the question back in somewhere around, I'm thinking it's 1200, 1300, somewhere in there. The question was brought up as to whether the beaver was fish or animal, because you had to be able to determine if you could eat it on Friday. If it was animal, then you shouldn't eat beaver, but if it was fish, then you could eat it on Friday. And I think it was the clerics at the Sorbonne, it was one of the major French universities that was essentially made up of church scholars, and they ruled that the tail of the beaver was fish and that the rest of the beaver was flesh. And so you could eat beaver tail on Friday. And it became such a delicacy to eat beaver tail on Friday that it is thought of by many naturalists as the reason why beavers just about died out in Europe. They were just eaten out of existence because it was a delicacy, and you could continue to eat it one more day of the week to eat beaver tail. And I don't know if there's any way of checking on that, but you can check on the discussion of whether a beaver was fish or animal. And we get into it in folklore because what it shows, you can trace back through some of these attitudes and customs that help you to understand certain kinds of directions that history has taken, or why people have acted the way they do, or why we eat chowder on Fridays or something. You know, seemingly superficial and trivial things, everyday things, and yet they sometimes have their roots in ancient traditions which have come down to us. Other times they can be as contemporary as the latest joke cycle. And all of these things, whether they're old or new, tie us together as members of meaningful groups.
You're listening to Dr. Barry Tolkien. This is Conversations. Barry, you've been talking around it in specifics, but you have written in the past how folklore is central to our experience of reality. Give us a general understanding of how that's so.
Well, it's one of those things like, how do you describe your mind to somebody? But you can try it. Sometimes you can start it with your own culture, or you can compare your own culture to somebody else's. I like to have my students just take a look at the different ways that cultures use time, for example. Just the customs about time, not the scholarly definition of time, not the scientific formal definition, but how you actually use time in your everyday life. And it's almost entirely dictated by folklore, folk tradition. What the concept late means, for example, is different at different times of the day and under different circumstances. Like if you have a class at 8 o'clock, you're expected to be there at 8 o'clock. The instructor can be there at 8:05 or 8:10, and the class will still wait. So a person who has power can use time differently or more arrogantly than somebody without power. The students are supposed to be there, but the professor can be late. Or you get a doctor's appointment for 2 p.m., and you're expected to be there, but you may not actually get in to see the doctor until 3. But he can do that to you, but you can't make him wait till 3. So there are different uses according to status that we all understand pretty much. Or what does it mean to be late to supper? If somebody tells you to come at 6, most of us will come at 6:10, 6:15, maybe 6:20, especially if you know there will be a lot of people there. Nobody will come at 5, as far as I know. That would be too pushy. Even 10 to 5 would be kind of arrogant. 10 to 6, but 10 after 6 is okay. There's a kind of a window when it's best. If you came at 7:15, you'd have to apologize. And an interesting question to ask is, where's the point at which you would have to start apologizing? You know, could you name it? And most people can't say, well, why, of course, it's an old rule, 623, and that's it, you know. But there isn't any rule. It's just a custom about it, and you sort of have to feel through it. So being late to class, being late to the doctors, being late to supper, late to your wedding, late to a funeral, late to a party, those are all different things. I mean, in some cases, it's 2 or 3 seconds. If you're late for your wedding, the bride is having a heart attack at about a half hour before the wedding's supposed to start. Never mind afterwards. I mean, they're all constructed differently. And in different cultures, all that stuff is quite different. Among most Native American groups, an event simply grows into being as everybody gets there and starts talking about it or doing it.
There is no 6 o'clock.
There isn't any 6 o'clock, yeah. Powwows, for example, are often advertised, you know, starts at 7:30, grand entry, 7:30. And in fact, people might be there at 7, tuning up their drums and getting their stuff on, and maybe by 8 or 9, the grand entry will have taken place, but nobody will time it. It has to do with when the drums are ready and when the dancers are ready and when everybody's lined up, and it's the event that's taking everybody's attention and not the clock. And yet the Anglos, who have showed up at 7:20 with their squirming kids, you know, are getting upset. You know, it's 8, 7, 7:30, 7:45, 8 o'clock. How come these Indians are always late? Because the whites are watching the clock and the Indians are watching the event. And you can go from one culture to another and just look at the way they use time or the way they use space or the way they process gender relations. And what you'll notice is that there's almost never anything on the rule books that defines any of that behavior. You learn it only by the custom of growing up with your people. And going along with those customs is a way of being normal. So if you find somebody else who does it another way, they are acting abnormal. You know, they're always late, or in other words, there's a defect there somewhere. Or if you go to Arabian countries, they're always standing too close to you. Or I don't know, you go to Japanese areas, and they're always too polite. I mean, whatever anybody does that's somewhat different from our own strikes us as really odd. And that can bring up tremendous ranges of friction for people who aren't aware that different cultures are different. Because they'll look in a book. They want to read a book about going to Japan, and they'll look in a book about Japan, and they find out how many people Japan has and how many railroad miles they have and how many tons of coal or whatever they import and all that kind of stuff. You get all the data and no knowledge. You know, I mean, you don't get any perspective about where you're supposed to stand or walk. In Japan, everybody walks to the left, for example. Single people. If you're walking by yourself, you always walk on the left side of the sidewalk. In America, you always walk on the right. So an American in Japan is always getting into these dodging acts with Japanese people. And the Japanese people think you're just causing trouble because everybody knows you should walk on the left. But everybody knows. I mean, it's not ever stated anywhere. It's so self-evident that everybody just does it. And so one of the ways to deal with a multicultural society, whether it's our own or whether you're working worldwide, is to be aware that there are different ways of dealing with time and space and gender. I'll tell you another one with gender that I've always found interesting is that most white Americans will talk about Indians as if they exploit their women, often referred to in English as squaws. I mean, English-speaking people think squaw is an Indian, generic Indian word across the country for women. It meant female for one language group, but not for the others. And whites will talk about Indians making their squaws do all the work or carry all the wood or haul all the water or something like that. And in fact, in a lot of tribes, the women do a lot of the work, but it's because they control the area that work represents. And so if they own the house, as the Navajos do, and own the children, and own the livestock, and own the plants that they're raising, naturally they would be the ones to get the water. If a man went to get the water, and they sometimes do, but if he went without negotiating it, somehow it would be like saying his wife couldn't handle her own responsibilities. It would be kind of an intrusion. Or you get to Japan and everybody notices Japanese women, traditional women, walk 3 paces behind their husband. And they might think that that's a degrading situation for women. And there are elements of Japanese gender roles that I think would register as degrading in our culture just because they devalue the women's input. But walking 3 paces behind the man is an interesting example because a lot of Japanese women I know don't see it as walking behind their husband. They describe it as letting the husband walk ahead so you can keep your eye on him because it's the woman who's usually carrying the money. The Japanese woman almost always determines whether the husband gets an allowance. The husband hands over his whole paycheck to his wife and she administers the household and all the expenses and all the bills, and she makes all the big decisions if they're going to go on a trip this year or not. The husband has the public face of being the head of the family. The woman is in fact the real head of politics in the family. So when they're in public, the woman shows deference to the husband. He walks ahead as if he's the head of the parade. She walks behind carrying the family pocketbook and deciding where they're going to stop to shop. So there, in other words, it may still not be a model you and I would feel comfortable with, but it's a different one than we think we're seeing. See, in other words, you have to know something about the custom that's represented and not just see the gesture as having all of the meaning. It's usually the gesture or the position or the role touches off some cultural values that very often the outsider doesn't know about. So what we do in folklore is try to know about those things. What do you have to ask? What do you have to try to understand? What do you have to try to see before you can understand what a gesture is, or whether somebody's too close to you, or whether someone's breaking in on you or manipulating time, or exploiting by gender or by status or some other way? You know, you have to know something else. Just like jokes don't have their own information in them. They touch off something else behind. And so we use those as a good example of folklore.
It seems to me in what you're saying that most expressions of folklore, most expressions of who we are unconscious. Is that an important aspect of it?
I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's another aspect, I think, a little bit separate from what I was talking about, but I think that's also true. I think we pick up a lot of patternings of our folklore unconsciously, maybe in two ways. There's the possibility that just as we might inherit the family looks, you know, the family nose and so on, it's possible that we also inherit ideas, which is one of the points that Jung made. And so we might have certain kinds of patterned expectations about reality that are part of our DNA, you might say, along with physical formations we might have, psychological. It's hard to test for it. But on another level, also, we see people acting a certain way. If we see people always looking each other in the eye when they're being earnest, then that's the way we grew up being earnest. And if we grew up in a Navajo Hogan where everybody avoids eye contact to be polite, then when we want to be polite, we do that. And it's not quite unconscious, but it's, say, out of conscious awareness. I mean, it's just like you can learn to drive and eventually you can talk at the same time. You don't have to concentrate on every movement you're making. And in culture, I think you pick up a lot of that before you're, say, 3 or 4 years old. You know, intonation, how to attract the attention of other people, and whether you're having eye contact or not, whether you hug or not, you know, body contact, proximity. Lots of things are just picked up sort of out of awareness because they're so common. And getting back to your earlier question, they become a part of our sense of normality on the basis of which we think we see reality. Mm. So if we grew up in a culture, for example, that thinks that dreams are really a projection of our active psychologies, which is the case with most American Indian tribes, then we're likely to pay attention to our dreams, remember them, talk about them with each other, get some advice from old folks about it. The Mojaves, for example, that's essentially what their whole culture is based on, is the discussion of dreams, the decoding of dreams for each other. But if we grow up in a culture in which the real world of physical things like tables and microphones and glasses and so on, that's reality, as you and I have probably done, at least I grew up in that world, where dreams then are, since they're intangible and unpredictable, they're degraded as sort of static or
entertainment
or flagrant misinformation. It's just your fantasy. Don't worry about it. It's only a dream. We tell our kids, you know, go back to sleep. You were only dreaming. That is, some very important psychological information may be coming our way, but our culture tells us whether to take it as reality or whether to take it as something else. And what that results in, of course, is that we very often then don't see something because we've been trained that it's not there. Or we've been trained to subordinate it so much that we don't notice it when it happens. There's a really, speaking of dreams, there's a good example. I don't know if we talked about it before, called the hag dream. Did we get into that? I mentioned it to some faculty members yesterday because it's a good example of something where most of the data have been there all along in folklore. And since it was in oral tradition, most scientists didn't take it seriously. And here's a phenomenon that actually occurs that was unknown in the scientific literature until about 20 years ago, because scientists, not believing that it was occurring, didn't pay any attention to it. I mean, in other words, it wasn't within their range of reality, and they didn't want to waste their time looking at fantasy. The dream is this, essentially. You have the feeling, you're on your back, you're in bed. Most people are asleep and then they wake up, or they have the sensation of waking up, and they feel that something's holding them down or riding on them. It usually crushes them so much they can hardly breathe, they can't cry out, they can't signal, they can't move. It's a paralyzing experience. I mean, actual experience of paralysis. Some people have it recurrently. Some people have it only once. Recent research indicates that about roughly 20% of any human populations you want to look at have had that dream. Like if you have a room full of Eskimos or a room full of engineers or a room full of school teachers, and you talk about this sensation for a while, you know, after a while, about 20% will say, yeah, I'm sure that was what it was. People interpret it differently. For some people, they actually see somebody come in the room and sit on them. And for many, it's described as an old hag. And so for short, we call it the hag attack or the hag experience. In the medieval period, we're sure that that's what they meant by the incubus and succubus. That was a mm-hmm. Latin term for a male or a female spirit who would sit on you and ride on you and attempt to have sex with you. The idea being to produce or to gather semen to inject in other people to somehow extend the powers of Satan in the world and so on. It was seen as an evil thing. And they believed you could make the succubus go away by making the sign of the cross on the roof of your mouth with your tongue or making the cross with your finger or something like that.
Concealed.
Concealed, but what it means is that some muscle that you're most likely to be able to move, and even though you may not be able to speak when you're paralyzed, you can sometimes move your tongue or twitch your finger or something. And, of course, they thought it was the sign of the cross that was warding off an evil spirit. But what we now know is if you can move any muscle, this sensation will start to go away. And what it is a kind of sleep paralysis. As you come out of REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, your muscle tone comes up partially so that you can move and turn over. You may not be totally awake or you may be totally awake, but usually whatever you want to call it, intelligence awakeness comes up and partly your muscle tone, and then you go back down into a deeper sleep. And that goes on in cycles. For some people, the muscle tone doesn't come up very far. And for some people, they wake up, but their muscle tone is just flat. And so they get the sensation of being paralyzed. And the brain will dramatize it as if somebody's causing you to be paralyzed, somebody's sitting on you. And some people actually describe a physical encounter with somebody sort of riding back and forth on them, jumping up and down. Well, where does folklore come in all this? This has been a topic in folklore since ancient times. I mean, the incubus and succubus thing are examples of medieval folk tradition about it. And more recently, you can study outport fishermen, but in specific, in St. John's, Newfoundland, where a study was made, something like more than 50% of the fishermen reported that they had this experience. And they call it the hag. And anytime you get the hag at night, then it's a sign that you shouldn't go out on your boat the next day. You'll be accident prone, or you'll have a disaster or something. Mm. I mean, if you wanted to phrase it in modern terms, maybe if you're that disturbed, if you're off your feed, so to speak, your systems aren't working right, then maybe you're coming down with something, or you're distracted some way, and you won't be at your best. And you have to be at your best on board a ship, or it'll be dangerous. So it's kind of a practical reading on your own psychology, I suppose. But they call it the hag, and if you've been hag-ridden all night, what you look like in the morning is haggard. I mean, that's where the word haggard mm-hmm. is now thought to come from, hag-rid, and so it's had an effect on our language. We now know that that's what most people meant by nightmare up until maybe 75 years ago. The M-A-R part of nightmare, the old Anglo-Saxon word is nichtmar, and mar means a crushing monster. It comes up in Danish and Norwegian, old Icelandic as Mara, who's a crushing monster, and the Nicht Mara is the crushing monster that comes at night. The thing is that here, lots of people have been telling these stories for ages and ages, and more recent scientists have said, yeah, it's just a story. People have nightmares, you know, you've eaten the wrong thing, you know, go to bed and call me in the morning, that kind of thing. Well, the person who did the first book on it, David Hufford, wrote a book called The Terror That Comes in the Night, where he used as data all the aggregate stuff he could collect from all the people who had ever had that experience to see if there were certain themes in it or if there were certain cultural explanations of it. And sure enough, in all the traditional cultures he looked at, from the fishermen of Newfoundland to natives in Africa and so on, most traditional peoples have an explanation for it. In other words, they recognize it, they have a name for it, they know how to act when you have it. In other words, your culture gives you a sense of reality. If you have this experience, you're not left alone thinking that you're going cuckoo, but your culture tells you, oh yeah, we know what that is. You call it so-and-so, you don't go to work tomorrow, or it means you need to go to a doctor or whatever. After that book came out, it drew the attention of psychologists who did further research on it, saying, gee, if there are that many people, I mean, you think, if 20% of the people had AIDS, you know, you'd have the National Guard called out or something. So suddenly people started to pay attention to the data there and to the statistics, and they started doing research. And sure enough, it comes up today it's described as a form of sleep paralysis. But the oddity is that you may have that experience and not know what it is and get scared to death by it. And a lot of people get it in the hospital because they're confined on their backs. And so a person who gets it in the hospital may not be willing to say anything to anybody about it for fear of, oh, my God, this is even worse than I thought. You know, they don't know what to say about it, how to describe it. Is it caused by the drugs or? And David Hufford, the author of this book, now works, teaches at Hershey Medical Center in Pennsylvania, where he goes, makes his rounds with his white coat with all the other doctors, and he interviews patients about their dreams. And whenever he encounters that one, he starts with other dreams and he gets them talking. When he encounters that one, he's able to fill them in on something that their culture could have told them about, but they've been, you know, most of us have been alienated from that kind of information. It's kind of a long way around, but it seems to me it's a good example of a case where folklore has to do with reality, not just reality itself, but whether you see something or not. In the case, if you've had that experience, you have seen it, but if you try to tell it to a scientist who doesn't believe in it, then he hasn't seen it. So there's that level of perception. But also how a culture helps its people to cope with psychological reality. And that's usually the role in a culture for folklore. A culture either dramatizes it or works it out or names it or gives you a prescription for it or something like that so that you're not left alone. The whole point in folklore is to tie you together with the values of the group. So it's a very nourishing, very supporting kind of system, or it can be.
This is Dr. Barry Tolkien. You're listening to Conversations. A brief word about Dr. Tolkien. His education came in these forms. He gained his PhD from the University of Oregon in English Literature, MA before that from Washington State, also in English, and his Bachelor of Science from Utah State University. Prior to that, he teaches folklore, regional folklore, American folklore, folk song and ballad, legend, myth, folktale, and more at Utah State University, where he's a professor of English and history and has been since 1985. Folklore looks at the parts. Does folklore tell you about the whole? If you were to, say, look at mainstream American culture, can you draw conclusions about who we think we are, who we are, what stage of understanding or blindness we are about each other? As I ask it, I think it's a huge question.
Yeah, I'm thinking that, too. I was about to say it doesn't work as well on that larger level in a multicultural country like this. But as soon as I started to think that, I think there are some exceptions to it. I think folklore is probably most at home in, if not small groups, at least intensely, perceived groups, like your ethnic background. Well, some people perceive their ethnicity more intensely than others. So people who are Hispanic and who have ties with Indian and Hispanic background and a Hispanic language and maybe the Catholic Church and maybe a particular area that has distinctive foods, those people are likely to have tears come to their eyes when they hear a local song or smell a certain food aroma, that sort of thing, or go to a wedding where the proper customs are still going on. And it defines them not as citizens of Mexico or citizens of the United States or citizens of the world, but as members of a very intense community. A lot of Anglo or European Americans get that sense of intensity only at scattered times during the year, like Norwegians when they suddenly have to eat lutefisk at Christmas time, or when Greeks who otherwise are just like everybody else go to a Greek wedding or a Greek funeral where there's a kind of an intensifying of dance, let's say, or costume or food or something. And so you can distinguish and study and collect and perceive folklore a lot more readily in these smaller groups, whether the folklore is sporadic or all the time, just because there's some kind of cultural contour you can follow and you can ask people about it. What's it like? What's this Greek food for and what's it called? You know, on the national level, in America, we've got so many of those different groups that a lot of us, I think, identify more with our family, let's say, or our religion or being Alaskans or something than we do with being Americans, except on the political level, you know, in terms of citizenship and political issues. But at the same time, there are kinds of folklore that unite virtually all people across the country. One is the contemporary legend, where there'll be a legend is a story that people tell that they actually believe happened, usually on the good authority of their neighbor, whether it's a loony story or not. And those stories just go right across the country so fast that you almost can't chart it. They seem to be told by everybody and anybody under almost any circumstances. And I think if you studied those legends in terms of their themes, I bet you could find some overall themes that seem to match bigger issues in America. I mean, one theme that comes up in these legends is the theme of the incompetent woman. And it seems to me that matches some of our stereotypes about women. Doesn't match the statistics, but the stereotype, the assumption. So you have lots of stories like the old lady who mistakenly blows up her poodle in the microwave, or mistakenly grinds up her son's frog. He left it in the family blender, and she gets panicked and pushes the wrong button. Or she panics in the car and drives it through the back of the garage. Or a man is out and he needs a push in his car, and a woman stops and he tells her, "Look, I have an automatic drive. I have to be going 35 miles an hour for the engine to catch." She says, "Fine," and he gets in his car and he looks in the rearview mirror and sees that she's backed up way down the road and she's coming at him at 35
miles an hour.
Lots of other examples. The girl who cooks her innards in the suntan parlor by signing up in too many suntan parlors, and somebody knows what hospital she's in, and so on. Women, if you just took the aggregate stories, you know, and there are hundreds of them like this, believed in by people who tell them, the women come across as incapable of dealing with electronic gadgets. They come across as vain, foolish, short-sighted, and so on. All the stereotypes about women that we thought we maybe had done away with, and they're still sort of lurking there in the culture. It's just that it's politically not so popular for people to joke about it openly anymore, and so it comes out in some other form. You get a lot of legends about minority groups and their alleged capacities and interests and inclinations. You get a lot of legends about how you don't know what's in mass-produced foods, like the mouse in the Coca-Cola bottle and the Kentucky Fried Rat and the finger in the spaghetti sauce and so on. I mean, if you had the time to add up all the themes, never mind telling the stories, but just the themes, they add up to some of our national prejudices, I think, and political directions. Same thing with jokes. I think jokes give us an immediate nationwide exposure to something that's rattling everybody in the country. They don't always go in every group. For example, during the years of the Polak joke, some of the best Polak jokes, in fact, the earliest collection of Polak jokes was put out by a group of Polish people. And the Polish people were telling Polak jokes to illustrate their arrival on the American scene. They had gotten to the point where they were so in that they could joke about how stupid their ancestors were. You get some of the same thing in some Jewish jokes, or Jewish people telling jokes about Jewish mothers and so on, inside jokes. You can really ridicule your own people from inside, and insiders know what you're talking about. But other people seized the Polak joke, I think, because it was right at a time when ethnic awareness was coming up and the Black is Beautiful movement was moving up, and other people were saying, well, gee, you know, why not have the Polish-American club too? And this was perceived by some Anglo-Americans as a threat to Americanism, and so we started joking about how dumb all these ethnic groups were. So the Polak joke told by outsiders had a different function than insider. Or the elephant joke, which Alan Dundes and Roger Abrams studied and concluded was actually a thinly disguised set of racial jokes. Not many of them were told by Black people, but they came out during the Civil Rights Movement, and they had themes of the elephant moving in too close, the elephant trying to disguise himself or herself by color, the supersexual elephant. That is, all the themes that came up in interracial conversations and interracial threats. And you had both pro-civil rights and anti-civil rights white people telling elephant jokes, thinking they were just little odd jokes. And when a folklorist friend of mine, Kenny Goldstein, told one of those to his Black secretary, she didn't laugh, and she said, how come you guys changed it to elephants? You used to call us monkeys. And apparently a lot of Black people were quite aware that these themes were very thinly disguised racial themes. But most Anglos, if you mention that to them, they say, not me, man, I don't have any racial prejudice. And the point is that joke cycles like that give us a view not into what I believe personally about another culture or what you might believe, but what's making the whole culture tingle at a certain time. And right at that point when those elephant jokes came out, it was the Civil Rights days. And no matter which side you were on the civil rights argument, everybody was all agog about the thing, and people were being murdered and people were waving flags and burning crosses, and it was up. Everybody was just tingling with it, with trepidation or with whatever, and the jokes touched all those things off. So in that sense, something can I think, give us a picture, to some extent, of larger things going on in the culture.
Well, we're looking at jokes. What about the Dahmer jokes, the mass murderer?
Yeah, mass murderer jokes, and there were several jokes that came out. In fact, the Dahmer and the Pee Wee Herman jokes came out almost
the same time.
Notice that with Dahmer, it wasn't simply that he killed a lot of people, but that he ate parts of them. And so you had something more horrible than usual in the news. And what happens is when people get threatened by that kind of stuff, the one one course of events is that they make jokes. I mean, one of the ways you can get power over something is to joke about it. But subtly, it's another way you can experience the taboo. I mean, you can sit around and tell a half hour of jokes about eating people's eyes and muscles and so on, which would otherwise be in bad taste if you simply brought it up in conversation. So it allows for the experience of those things which you're not supposed to, which are too crude to experience. And so there's a kind of a double face to it. You know, you can feel better about it in the sense that you can laugh about it and perhaps get rid of the trauma by redirecting your emotions, which is, I think, what happened with the shuttle disaster jokes, where nobody thought that was funny, but everyone was telling these ghastly jokes about it. But you can also then replay it. You know, you're continually, you know, you're experiencing cannibalism or exposure or public masturbation, that sort of thing, with the Pee Wee Herman stuff. People disapproved of it, were made uncomfortable by it, but because of the irony between this little twerp on TV and this rather goofy sort of, it made me wonder, what are the police doing hanging around in porno joints waiting for somebody to act off color? You know, what does anybody expect? But no matter how you think about it in practical terms, what it did in image terms is that one of our childish idiots from TV turned out to be kind of a dangerous adult. And so you have to somehow cope with that discrepancy. And with Dahmer, you've got this discrepancy of an apparently a relatively good-looking young guy who eats people and is homosexual. And so, you know, you've got ironies that you can play with by telling these jokes.
Let's look at Dumb Blondes. Dumb Blondes have come into the joke cycles lately.
And fast. And I've got a couple of guesses about Dumb Blonde jokes, and I'm not sure I'm right, but I the more of them I see, the more I'm convinced that I'm right. But I should preface it by saying this. I don't think, whether you're talking about art or jokes or space flight, I don't think one explanation ever covers anything. And in folklore, one of the things we look for, like with a joke cycle, is not just that something happened that caused trauma, for example, like the shuttle disaster, but something else associated with it usually is involved in the jokes. And in the shuttle disaster jokes, most of them focused on the teacher. So it wasn't just that a bunch of test pilots blew up, but a teacher, you know, our surrogate parent blew up. And in fact, one of the jokes was, did you hear that Krista McAuliffe was a perfect teacher? She only blew up once in front of her class. I think there was another trauma among many people that the teacher had given everything, and that's not one of the things we had expected. Now, in the case of the Dumb Blonde jokes, I'm equally convinced that there are several things going on. First of all, I think there's that sort of residual undercurrent of putting women down, and we've always had the Dumb Blonde image, you know. Marilyn Monroe, as sexy as she may have been, was often cast as the dumb blonde, the silly woman who didn't know any better, both in movies and in everyday life. And we have had dumb blonde jokes for a long time, but not in the numbers that have suddenly come up. So you've got a denigration or at least a subordination of a figure of the beautiful, the prototypically beautiful woman. So something's going on there. You've got the notion that's widespread in America that women, especially the more romantic they are, the more dumb they seem to be. And I think in more recent years, you've got a kind of a response, maybe a whiplash or a knee-jerk response to feminism, where for several years now we've had very outspoken women who have sort of subordinated their possibilities at looking beautiful for the possibility of projecting the idea of being articulate and powerful and politically organized, and didn't want to be seen as bubbleheads or pretty folks, but humans with some kind of a venture in mind. So there's been a tendency to subordinate good looks, not to swallow it altogether, but to downplay that at any rate. And so I think that's in there somewhere. I think that some of this is a response to women thinking they're so damn smart. What you've got in the dumb blonde jokes is women being just generically stupid. But I looked through these jokes, and we've got a list here, which we won't read because some of them are pretty wild.
Pretty gross.
Some of them are as gross as you can get. But if you go through them just quickly as I did, through three or four pages here, looking for themes that might give us a hint, there are several themes. A lot of these jokes have to do with self-destructive activities. One that I can think of that I didn't see in this list is there's a blonde and a brunette standing on a bridge about to commit suicide. Which one jumped first? And the answer is the brunette. The blonde needed some direction, or the blonde needed to be shown the way. So you've got that kind of a theme throughout these things, with blondes doing things that are self-destructive or that lead to death. Why, if you see a blonde in the bottom of a swimming pool, what do you know happened? Somebody installed a scratch and sniff pad at the bottom of the pool.
Or a mirror.
Or a mirror. Or what do you call a bunch of blondes drowned at the bottom of a pool? An air bubble. I mean, notice you've got, if you just look for themes, you've got dead blondes who have willingly killed themselves, in effect, because they're stupid. So it's self-destructive as well as getting doing away with women. A lot of these jokes have to do with sex. A lot of them have to do with contraception, ignorance about sexuality. What did the blonde say when she found out she was pregnant? There are several answers I've heard. One is, gee, I hope it's mine, or I wonder if it's mine, or I hope it's not mine. I would see that as another timely theme, and along with the stupidity, and especially with the theme of not being able to make up your mind, what this reminds me of a lot is the current debate on abortion. Abortion and contraception, but especially abortion right now is hot, and I'm wondering if that's not why these jokes are coming up in great number now, because something's hot on the scene. And this has nothing to do with the details of abortion, whether you believe in it or not, and if you do, how you would go about it and what kinds of advice people need. But the nationwide discussion of it strikes me as being a discussion of whether women ought to be allowed to make up their own minds or not. And what that does is dramatically cast women in the role of people who don't know whether they should or not. They need a crowd gathered around the clinic to tell them not to, for example. And it casts the woman, either pro or con, as a person who doesn't know enough to make up her own mind. The people who are pro-choice deal with some of the other people as if they can't think. The so-called pro-life people deal with the pro-choice people as if they're not thinking, as if both of them are destructive, as if they're killing off babies or being willing to kill off women, as if women are willing to kill off themselves by being too stupid to make up their minds. And I don't know, to my mind, that echoes a lot of these themes in these jokes. That's not to say that people who tell dumb blonde jokes are consciously thinking about the abortion issue, but the abortion issue may have upgraded our tensions to the point where jokes like this can touch off several things at once, and then we laugh. That's my guess, anyway.
And the folks who tell these jokes would look at you and say, Barry, it's a joke.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, every joke is just a joke. I mean, it's either funny or it's not. If it's not funny, nobody's ever going to tell it again. See, I wouldn't argue that there isn't a surface level that is either cute or a nice turn of words or an ironic twist of image or phrase. I mean, otherwise it's not a joke, obviously. But that in itself doesn't explain why certain jokes at certain times. I mean, if the shuttle jokes were just funny, for example, because of a twist of phrasing, why aren't we still telling them? Or if the elephant jokes were just pleasant absurdities, why aren't we still telling them? They're just as absurd today as they were then. Why did we start telling suddenly so many dumb blonde stories or jokes? I want to look back and notice that the moron stories, the moron jokes back in the 40s were being told, as I remember this as a kid, were being told not by kids but by parents. And I can only connect that now in retrospect with the fact that that's when most schools were starting to do IQ exams. And I wonder if parents, maybe not consciously, but I just wonder if parents were worried about who's dumb and who isn't and were sort of joking about it to whistle in the dark, you might say, wondering about if their kids were. But on the other hand, I noticed that when my kids were small, their favorite jokes were dead baby jokes. And they would tell them at the table, you know, describing people unloading dead babies with pitchforks and that sort of thing. And I would forbid them to tell these at the table. And one of my kids said one time, "What do you care, Dad? People don't like babies anymore." I said, "How could you say that?" Well, he couldn't explain it. But it dawned on me later, that was in an era, that was in the 60s, when I think maybe for the first time we were all openly discussing things like contraception, zero population growth, family control, family planning. I mean, to kids, after all, who aren't interested in the politics of all this, it must have sounded like the whole adult world was discussing whether kids should be around or not. And I wonder if that didn't suggest the notion of killing kids. Notice, it's not as morose as it sounds. It's not that the kids thought we were trying to kill them off, but in the discussion of whether there ought to be kids or not, one of the ways kids could dramatize that frustration or anxiety would be to dramatize somebody killing kids. See, I mean, I don't think they were being very intellectually astute about it. They were simply dramatizing a sense of anxiety or concern, doubt, something like that. And I think you can usually, if you look carefully enough, you can usually find some kind of historical context for every major joke cycle that's come around if you watch the themes that are in the jokes. I mean, the shuttle disaster was obvious. I mean, there was the disaster and there were the jokes within 20 minutes. People weren't telling a shuttle disaster joke the day before in anticipation that someday a shuttle might blow up. I mean, it would have been equally absurd, but nobody was doing it. So in that case, I think the event triggered off the jokes. And some of these others, I think the trigger isn't so sudden. It's kind of a social agitation or electricity that mounts up, and then eventually something becomes the lightning rod and everybody starts doing it. You find the same thing with graffiti. Somebody will write one little clever graffiti in a men's restroom near the stand-up urinals, and within a month you'll get a whole network of graffiti all responding to that one line. Why wasn't it there before? You know, something sort of sparks off something else. And I think that's the way folklore operates anyway, whether we're talking about jokes or food customs or something. It's sort of, folklore has the capacity to reinforce itself when it makes sense within a culture. But it's hard as can be to try to explain why I eat turkey at Thanksgiving. I can give a historical picture, I can give a family picture, I can say we've always done it, but that's not anything to do with metabolism. You see what I mean? The rational explanation almost never tells you anything.
No, it's Thanksgiving.
That's Thanksgiving.
That's why you eat turkey.
Yeah. It's why. And it's mood, and it's repetition of something that makes you feel good and normal. And and jokes, I think, are repetitious, dramatic attempts to sort of even out or re-experience things that give us anxiety or concern. That is, different kinds of folklore function in different ways. But if they don't ring a bell for the person who hears them, they'll cease to exist. So the very fact that they continue to exist has to mean something. And I can't believe that jokes only exist because they're clever and absurd, because then they would exist for a long time. But they tend to follow these little elements that go along in our history. But you see, I may be totally missing the boat on the blonde jokes. There may be something else going on in America today that I'm not thinking of. And if anybody knows, I'd love to hear your thoughts about it. It just seems to me that humans, with jokes like this, with themes so recurrent, I just can't believe that it's aimless. You know, it just didn't fall out of the sky last week. It's got to be a reference to something that's bothering people. And so, and it's likely, according to my dictum at any rate, it's likely to be several things. And something has crystallized it, all those things together.
Once again, this is Dr. Barry Tolkien, and this is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Barry Tolkien has written two books. One is The Dynamics of Folklore, published by Houghton Mifflin in 1979. The more recent, The Ballad and the Scholar, from 1986. We're not laughing very much about the recent Clarence Thomas and Anita mm-hmm. Hill hearings. A couple of jokes here and there, but nothing like the rush of Dahmer yeah. jokes, the blonde jokes, yeah. elephant jokes, yeah. and it was ripe for it.
You know, I've wondered about that, because I expected a deluge of Clarence Thomas jokes, and as you say, there have been a few. And I wonder if it's not because we got all of our kicks on TV during that period of time. That is, if there was anything you ever wondered about sexual terminology in the office, you heard it several times. And I must say, since I've been interested in interracial relations for a long time, one of the topics I noticed that always comes up when interracial relations comes up is the topic of sex. And it's usually the fear by lighter-skinned people that darker males are out to get our women. And so one of the favorite topics among whites is the sexual capacity of blacks. It comes up in jokes. It comes up in legends. I mean, blacks hear about it so often that it makes them sick. And here was the whole. I mean, here were our congressmen sitting in front of the TV, playing with one of the most dangerous and recurrent stereotypes in American conversation. That is the sexuality of black people. And I think it kind of stunned folks to hear so much of it out in public that normally got whispered behind the scenes. And maybe it's that most of us didn't have any other questions to ask when all of that was over. But there are some residual questions. And I think that's where the jokes are going to come in. For example, there's still a residual question about why Anita Hill waited so long to say something. Granted, maybe she was scared. But the other side is, well, maybe she thought it was an opportune time to do something. I mean, those of us who aren't in the know have got several things to juggle. And that's where one of the jokes I've heard has come in, the Anita Hill doll. You pull her string and 10 years later she talks. Mm. And so I'm just wondering if that's not those little discrepancies that are going to form the jokes. But by now, the subject has been so steamrolled by everybody, it's not considered a very clever matter anymore. So maybe it's taken all the materials that we might have used for jokes, we as a culture, maybe we don't need them. I just don't know. Maybe people are coming out with those jokes cautiously because no one wants to come up as a racist or as a sexist, because those are sensitive and topics, and rightly so. So maybe they'll emerge in a while. Maybe there'll be a lag. But it can't last too long, because then people are very fickle. They won't remember who Clarence Thomas is. They will, partly because he's on the Supreme Court, but Anita Hill will start to fade. And so there'll be a kind of a window of opportunity here, and if the jokes don't come up, then they won't be timely.
There's another event of summer, and this is the one I wanted to ask about, where Folkway ran up against Folkway and there was a clash. The Atlanta Braves fans have a tomahawk yell, mm-hmm. and that's a Folkway.
Yeah, it's become a kind of a sport Folkway, folk gesture.
It ran up very hard against the feelings of Native Americans about how they should be treated, who should be called an Indian, what should a tomahawk be.
Yeah. I must say, a lot of Native Americans I know saw it as a convenient opportunity to bring up issues which are still unsettled, and they don't really care whether the Braves have that gesture or not. There are other Indians who feel that they're insulted every time somebody borrows a stereotype and makes it into a kind of a mascot. You know, the Indians are supposed to be ferocious warriors, so everybody wants to name a team after the Indians. And so, of course, that leads to mascots who dance around on the field with feathers or some kind of a big-nosed Indian on the front of the sports jacket and the tomahawk chop. I mean, you find it all over the country. A lot of Indians just feel that that's demeaning, and just in general terms. the Indians I know don't really feel that gestures like that are that exclusive. Mm-hmm. If you want to wave a tomahawk, so, you know, that's you. If you want to be an idiot, they'd say go ahead. I think where they feel that it's worth saying something is that if you do it in such a way that it's demeaning to the people. See, waving a tomahawk doesn't break any taboo. It doesn't intrude in anybody's religion. Indians would feel differently, for example, if you decided to have your mascot be a Hopi snake dancer, and so your guy would come out and jump around with a rubber snake in his mouth or something to parody the Hopi sacred rituals of rain that have to do with dancing with live rattlesnakes. And then Indians would say, look, you're screwing around with some tribal religious custom and you ought not to do it. This one, I think Indians just think it's in poor taste, and some Indians I've talked to don't really care whether they do it or not. So in some ways, it's not so much a collision. You hear more white people talking about it than Indians. Mm-hmm. I would wish that white people would just quit using Indians generally. I mean, they use them to represent motorcycles and teams. And what they do is take the ferocity rather than the humanity of the Indian usually. And so it's a stereotype. It's an evaluative stereotype. All Indians, the Indians have been so used to that from the beginning that it's just one more case. You find it in more ethnic groups, though. Like a lot of times people who own Mexican restaurants will, if they have a picture of a woman in their advertisement, it'll be a tall, slender woman wearing a Spanish outfit. The mantilla, the lace, you know, the skirt, be very graceful looking. If it's a man, up until very recently, he'll be short and dumpy, and he's shown asleep on the ground or leaning up against a cactus. You know, it's a Frito Bandito. The men are little fat bandits, or else they're asleep, and the women are tall and graceful Spaniards. I mean, those are also stereotypes, and Hispanic folks have had to put up with that nonsense for a long time, the advertisement of food utilizing racial or ethnic stereotypes. I just saw around here on campus an auction advertised as a Chinese auction by some local Lutheran church, and I'm wondering what they mean by Chinese auction. I mean, it's really a bigger picture. And in that sense, there's a collision all the time. When somebody feels that you can sort of get cute by using somebody else's ethnic reference, then I think there's a collision. In fact, I wonder that the ethnic groups are as dignified as they are about it. You know, I don't know any. For example, you go to an Indian reservation, and I have yet to run into an Indian basketball team, you know, named the Whites or something like that, or the White Marauders, or something, you know, just a parody white ferocity. The other ethnic groups usually don't act that way. It's mostly ours, unfortunately, that manipulate the others. And rather than a collision, I think it's a form of tacky exploitation that we could get along without.
Well, but Barry, we've got about 5 minutes left. I know you feel very strongly about the diverse American culture and how we as a as mainstream Americans fail to recognize our diversity or to value it. But I want to ask you up on the box for the last couple of minutes so you can take a look at that for us. What's our failing in not seeing ourselves as a diverse, rich, complicated culture made up of many small cultures?
Well, I think it's a loss more than a failing. I mean, it is certainly it's based on some failings of our failing of an ability to see beyond our own culture. The loss is the loss of richness in our lives that we should be experiencing. We've tended to take the view over historical, over the, say, past a couple hundred years, that our ancestors, meaning by that our white ancestors who came here to establish a country with freedom and democracy and so on, that they had such a special idea that only they should set the tone for it. And so there was the notion that to be an American, variation wasn't going to be allowed. And we developed this very unfortunate concept of the melting pot. That is, everyone was supposed to melt and be alike. And the implication was that you should melt and be biologically alike, too. That is, all of us who look alike and are white, it doesn't matter to you or to me whether I'm German and you're Norwegian in background. We're sort of like white folks in America. We get along just fine. So biologically, a lot of people have melted. And the thought was that culturally we would melt and we'd all be alike. And so to be different, you know, to call attention to your racial difference, to say black is beautiful, or to join the German-American club or something like that, was for some people like saying they weren't pleased at being an American. They got into trouble for it. Germans got tarred and feathered during World War II, for example. Japanese Americans got thrown in a series of concentration camps because they, being different, they were thought to be part of the enemy, even though they were American citizens. Their citizenship didn't really, in fact, ensure them equal treatment. So, in fact, we haven't turned out to be alike. People are still afraid. My feeling is that if we could understand each other and not try to be all alike and instead register these differences and enjoy them, just as many people enjoy eating in different kinds of restaurants, you can also enjoy living in a culture that has a wonderful variety of people in it who don't all see things the same way. That should be a source of scientific discovery for us, a source of art for us. I mean, if you look at any subject another way, you'll discover something else about it. This is why a lot of our scientists today are American Indians. Not many people know that. Not many people know that it was an American Indian who first entered Japan when it was illegal for anybody to go into Japan before Commodore Perry, an American Indian, got himself shipwrecked over there intentionally and taught some Japanese people to speak English. And it was they who became the interpreters when Perry landed in Japan. I mean, some of our leaders in this country, in intellectual activity and art and history, science, have been people of other groups, and they've used their own cultural perspectives to do what they do. I think we've benefited from that. And the old melting pot theory that tried to get us all into one mold was a way of denying that richness. It's worth saying that the government, since 1976 at any rate, has proclaimed that the melting pot theory is not the American theory anymore. And diversity is now what America has, and the richness of American life. The establishment of the American Folklife Center in the Library of Congress had that as the basic finding, that an American ought not to be forced to give up his ethnic background in order to be an American. Being an American is a political fact of citizenship. Being Polish, being Athabascan, being Eskimo, those are ethnic facts that allow for richness in life. And that, since 1976, at least officially from the government's perspective, is seen as a strength in America rather than a weakness. But we've got a whole school system that was built by people who tried to wipe out differences, and families who gave up speaking foreign languages because they thought their kids would be ridiculed, you know. So we have several generations to try to get back to where we were. And in the meantime, some cultures have been trammeled right out of existence. So, yeah, I think, you know, we've been guilty of killing some of the flowers in the garden before we found out that they were flowers. And I don't like to go around feeling guilty about it. I don't think I've done that, not to sound holier than anyone else. I don't think that a program like this should cause us to, you know, scratch our guilts once more and go around lamenting about what we've done to the poor natives and so on. I think it's just a matter of responsibility rather than guilt, you know, knowing that we have a kaleidoscope culture, knowing that they're going to participate in our culture and make it richer, why not go out and learn about it and learn their languages and find out what's going on instead of being afraid of them, you know, instead of worrying about the sexual practices of the blacks, you know, I mean, there are lots of better things to do that have nothing to do with fear and have to do with richness of our total life situation.
Thanks,
and
Barry.
That's where folklore comes in.
Thanks a lot. Dr. Barry Tolkien with us again on Conversations. We hope you'll return in the future.
I'll try to as often as I can.
Good. And I hope you'll join me again next week. I'm Susan McGinnis.